morning and welcome to everybody. I'm Jeff Denver for God's Own Stress. I know each and every person here. And I'm glad you're here. This is going to be a great conversation. First, before I introduce our guest of honor, we go around and invite each person to introduce themselves so that everybody at the table and our guest knows who is who. But we'll start with you, Chloe.
My name is Chloe Dipanev, and I work here at the Legato Institute with Anne Applebaum in the Political Studies Department.
My name is John Penning. I work for the Swedish Embassy with Press and Media.
I'm Toby Matthew. I'm the chairman of the publishing company with Atlantic Books, and I'm on the advisory board with the Gossips.
I'm William Shawcross. I try to write in some of the latest things that Marcus writes about the printing.
I'm Rocky Gow. I'm married to April Gow, who's there. I'm the founder of the recently formed Asia Scotland Institute, with its mission to get young Scots to re-engage with the part of the world where their forebears were very energetic.
My name is Dawood Azami. I work for the BBC World Service, and I also teach at the University of Westminster. And I'm an alumni of the school, summer school.
My name is Garvin Walt. I am the foreign policy columnist for the Conservative Home website.
I'm Howard Murray. I'm strategic conflict analyst at Integrity Research and Consulting and presenter young officer in the British Army.
Good morning. I'm Pavel Bobek from the Embassy of the Czech Republic.
I'm Alana Puta. I'm a program director here.
I'm Holly Bigham, and I work in the communications department here at the Legato Institute.
I'm April Gow. I'm a partner at Knight & White and a philanthropic advisory firm.
Well, thank you. Max, thank you. The Legato Institute does a lot of work in democratic transition, a lot of work in free market economics, and a lot of work in culture. We don't do military affairs, but we do Max Boot. When we heard that Max would be in London, we grabbed the opportunity to host him. Max is a longtime friend of mine. We got to know each other first, maybe, Max, when you were editing the op-ed page for the Wall Street Journal, and I was writing for you from time to time. Max has spent a lot of time, among other things, in and writing about Iraq and Afghanistan in recent years. Max is prolific, and as William said, really quite brilliant, a very able researcher, and has developed a niche in thinking, among other things, about leadership and about strategy. And from that comes this book. I would be eager to hear from you, Max, on anything you have to say about this grand new publication, which you know about and we've written to you about, and some of you have already read. But and I think you have a presentation, but I'd just like to know where the idea came from at the start, and how it developed, and how you came to the conclusion that this was the book for you to write right now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you, and I thank Jeff for hosting me. I've known Jeff across a number of jobs over a number of years, and all I know is that he does every job superbly well, and I know that Legato is no exception to that trend. Well, to answer your immediate question, I came to write this book simply because of my experience of writing about and occasionally traveling to Iraq and Afghanistan over the course of the last decade. And as I watched those wars unfold, I became ever more interested in trying to figure out what was the big historical picture here. How usual or unusual were the things that I was seeing, and what were the trends in insurgency and counterinsurgency, and how were they reflected or not reflected in what was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that is what set me off on this six-year historical odyssey, which has now culminated in the publication of what I'm afraid is this exceedingly thick book. What I've done in this book is actually audacious and perhaps foolhardy, which is to try to encompass 5,000 years of guerrilla warfare history between two hardcovers. What I'm going to do here this morning is even more audacious and possibly even more foolhardy. I'm going to try to encompass those same 5,000 years into about 25 minutes. So if you're really good at math, you can instantly calculate that works out to about 160 years per minute. So fasten your seatbelts, we're going for a rapid historical ride. The question I get asked most often when I tell people that I've been working on this book about the history of guerrilla warfare, aside from the one that Jeff just asked, which is one I certainly hear about, what led you to your interest in that subject. The other question I hear most often is, what was the first guerrilla war? And the answer is, it's very hard to say, because in fact, guerrilla warfare is as old as mankind. Tribal warfare is essentially guerrilla warfare, because tribes, after all, don't have a command and control structure, they don't wear uniforms, and they don't engage in the kind of frontal, toe-to-toe battle that has often been characterized as the Western way of war. Instead, they engage in ambush and raid and stealth, attacking enemy villages and then falling back before the warriors of the opposing tribe can come up and inflict punishment. Those are the characteristics both of tribal warfare and of modern guerrilla warfare. By contrast, conventional warfare is a relatively recent invention. By definition, you cannot have conventional armies without a nation state. And you did not have states until about 5,000 years ago, when they arose around 3000 BC in Mesopotamia. You needed to have that state to provide logistics, command and control, bureaucracy, all the things that make a conventional army function. But even once you had the first conventional armies created by the first states, many of their enemies were not other conventional armies. Many of their enemies, in fact most, were rebels from within, nomadic raiders from without. In other words, essentially, guerrilla fighters. Now, what that suggests to me is that the way we think about the entire subject is all screwed up, because we talk about irregular warfare, unconventional, implying there's something wrong with it. This is not the way one is supposed to fight. But in fact, this is the way that mankind has always fought and still fights to this day. And this is a very knowledgeable and learned group here, so let me throw out a trivia question at you, which is, what was the last conventional war that the world has seen? Last conventional war pitting two uniformed military forces against one another.
Vietnam.
No, more, that wasn't, actually, it was not a conventional war, and it's more recent than that.
India against Pakistan in the Kargil conflict.
No.
The expulsion of Iraq.
I'm not surprised it's not stripping off anybody's tongue, because it's not an obvious war. But it was the Russian.
Yes, sir.
It's the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008. It was not exactly a major conflict. I think that indicates to you how rare conventional warfare is in the modern world. But that's not an exception. Conventional warfare has always been the aberration, not the norm. And we need to adjust our thinking to take light of that fact. It's not just the modern British Army or the modern American Army or the modern French Army which have to spend much of their time and energy fighting irregular warriors. This has ever been the lot of all organized military forces throughout history, including, of course, the greatest military force of antiquity, the Roman legions, who were pretty formidable even when not led by Russell Crowe. Despite Russell Crowe's inspired leadership, however, as we know, Rome did ultimately fall. And what led to the collapse of Rome? Well, Rome was much like the modern United States, a superpower without peer. It was not surrounded by near-peer rivals. And yet, it was surrounded by enemies, those whom the Germans, whom the Romans charmingly called barbarians. And who were the barbarians? Well, they were essentially tribal fighters. They did not have the conventional military structure of the Roman legions. They fought, in essence, as raiders or as guerrillas. In fact, the collapse of Rome was precipitated by the entry of the Huns into Europe, this fierce race of steppe archers who invaded Europe and eventually helped to bring down the Roman Empire under their fierce leader, Attila. A 4th century Roman historian left a description of how the Huns operated that I think is very interesting and evocative. He wrote, "They are very quick in their operations, of exceeding speed, and fond of surprising their enemies. They suddenly disperse, then reunite, and again, after having inflicted vast loss upon the enemy, scatter themselves over the whole plain in irregular formations, always avoiding a fort or an entrenchment." Now, I would submit to you, that's a pretty good description of guerrilla warfare, whether practiced so long ago by the Huns or is practiced today by so many insurgent groups around the world. Now, by stressing the ancient origins of guerrilla warfare, I do not by any stretch mean to suggest that nothing has changed over the millennia. There obviously have been some significant changes. To my mind, the most important of all is the growth of what I call the three P's: politics, propaganda, and public opinion. These are all factors that did not trouble insurgents or counterinsurgents too much in the days of Attila, but have taken on leading importance in our own day. The conflict, which to my mind symbolizes the change and the transformation of irregular warfare, is one that is near and dear to the hearts of my countrymen, which is, of course, our war of independence from this great country. A battle which was waged not only with muskets and bayonets, but also with instruments of information warfare, such as Thomas Paine's famous pamphlet, Common Sense. Now, when we think about the battles of the American Revolution, we tend to think about encounters like Lexington and Concord, where the redcoats were very aggrieved to find these Yankee scoundrels who would fire from behind rocks and trees and fight in other ways that were not considered gentlemanly or not quite cricket. And there was an element of that, certainly, in the battles of the American Revolution. But I would submit that the story of the American Revolution cannot really be understood with reference only to what happened in North America. In fact, I would argue that the pivotal event actually happened not far from here. The kind of standard narrative of the American Revolution is that the war ended at Yorktown in 1781 when Lord Cornwallis surrendered roughly 7,000 troops to General Washington. That was the last major battle of the American Revolution. Well, that's true, but it need not have worked out that way, because even after defeat at Yorktown, the British Empire still had tens of thousands of troops in North America, tens of thousands more throughout the rest of the empire, and tens of thousands more who could have been hired from the German states. It still had vast power. And I can guarantee you that if the colonists had been fighting not the British Empire, but the Roman Empire, the story would not have ended there. The Romans had a way of coming back from defeat, and I strongly suspect that if they had been fighting the American founding fathers, Washington, Jefferson, and the like, would have found themselves getting crucified quite literally. The fact that this did not happen is because of a factor that the British Empire in the late 18th century had to take account of that the Roman Empire did not. That factor was public opinion, a phrase that did not appear in print for the first time until that fateful year, 1776. Ultimately, the turning point for the American Revolution occurred in the House of Commons, where on February 28th of 1782, you had a very close division, 234 to 215. By that very narrow margin, the House voted to discontinue offensive operations in North America. This was a stinging blow to Lord North, the hardline Tory Prime Minister, who was bent on fighting the American colonists. It led to his downfall and the rise of Lord Rockingham and his Whigs, who were committed to a policy of conciliation with their American brethren. Now, I would submit to you, this was a pretty big deal, because here you had this great power, the superpower of its day, that was not truly defeated on the battlefield, nevertheless decided to stop fighting because of the power of public opinion, which have turned against the war, as in fact many in the colonies had tried to do all along, with documents such as the Declaration of Independence or Thomas Paine's Common Sense, appealing to public opinion, not only on the home front, not only on the battlefield states in North America, but also on the British home front. This is a very successful strategy, and one that has been followed in subsequent centuries by various groups that have also fought American power, of course, in places like Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. It's actually, this is a truly monumental development that this could affect the course of a major war. And public opinion would prove to be pretty influential in the writings of the most of the greatest theorist of insurgency of the 20th century, Mao Zedong. In 1938, after the Long March, working in a cave in northern China, Mao wrote his great classic, On Protracted War. And he was famous for his aphorism, "The people are like water, and the army is like fish." He stressed the need to keep the closest possible relations with the common people. He told his troops, "Be courteous and polite. Pay for all articles. Establish latrines a safe distance from people's houses," and so forth and so on. Now, this was not advice you could imagine Attila giving to his Huns. He did not worry too much about how the Huns treated the common people. Now, why did Mao worry? Was that because he was a great humanitarian? I would suggest not. In fact, his moral character was probably no higher than that of Attila the Hun. But he understood, Mao did, that warfare had changed in the 20th century. One could no longer be a successful nomadic raider as the Huns had been. In the modern age, to be a successful insurgent group, you have to have a base area, and you have to have a place where you can raise intelligence, food, recruits, everything you need to grow your forces. And to do that, you have to be on the right side of the people. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to always win their love and support, but however you do it, you have to be able to control the population. And so part of that in Mao's thinking was, you have to be careful not to mindlessly offend the peasantry with the misconduct of your troops. Public opinion looms even larger when it comes to terrorism, which the anarchists of the 19th century defined as propaganda by the deed. Still a pretty good definition, because terrorists are even weaker than guerrillas. They cannot possibly hope to defeat a conventional military force in open battle. All they can do is set off a few big explosions, create a few headlines, and hope to change and influence public opinion. The most influential insurgent of our day went so far as to say that the media war is 90% of the whole in the waging of jihad. 90%. That's how much importance Osama bin Laden attached to information operations. Now, I would suggest that the growing power of public opinion helps to account for one of the interesting trends that I uncovered in the course of my research. I mean, most of this book is just a straight narrative of campaigns and colorful personalities, the likes of Garibaldi and Michael Collins, T. Lawrence, Lord Wingate, and many others. But at the end of the book, I also make what is for me a very rare venture into the thickets of social science, because I have a database at the end of the book analyzing insurgencies since 1775. And what that database shows is that insurgencies have been getting more successful. Prior to 1945, the win rate for insurgencies was about 20%. Since 1945, the win rate has gone up to roughly 40%. So what accounts for that increasing effectiveness of insurgency? Well, part of the answer is no doubt the spread of ever more powerful weapons, which I'll talk about in a minute. But I think the biggest part of the explanation is the power of public opinion, which is the great equalizer. That is what allows even a relatively puny military force to bring down a great power or a superpower. On the other hand, I don't want to get too carried away here, and there is a tendency to go too far in a direction of deifying guerrillas as these superhuman fighters who could not possibly be defeated by military force. A lot of that is really based on the post-war success of a handful of high-profile insurgents like Mao in China or Ho Chi Minh. But remember the figure I just cited to you. Even if 40% of insurgencies are successful in the post-World War II era, what's the flip side of that? Well, obviously 60% are not being successful. And just as very few business startups will ever become an Apple or a Microsoft, so too, very few fledgling insurgencies will ever become a Chinese Red Army or a Viet Minh or Viet Cong. And to make that point, I would cite to you one of the most famous insurgents of all time, a man whose visage once used to decorate every dorm room wall on the planet, and actually probably still decorates every dorm room wall at my alma mater, which is UC Berkeley. Now, what made Che Guevara such a great boon for makers of t-shirts and posters? Well, the obvious answer is the success that he and Fidel Castro had in the 1950s in overthrowing the Batista regime in Cuba, which seems pretty remarkable at first blush, because here you had a few hundred ragtag fighters in the hills overthrowing this well-established regime with 40,000 troops, tanks, aircraft, artillery, all of the paraphernalia of modern war as supplied by the US of A. However, their success in overthrowing Batista becomes a lot more understandable if one examines the situation a little bit more closely and sees that Batista was fundamentally unpopular, illegitimate, corrupt. He had very little popular support. By the time of his downfall, he'd even lost the support of the Chamber of Commerce. If a regime is losing the support of the Chamber of Commerce, that's not a good sign. That's why Castro and Che and their crew were able to overthrow Batista as easily as they did. But, like many successful generals throughout history, Che suffered from a case of hubris, and he thought that he could emulate elsewhere the success that he had had in Cuba. This was an illusion of which he was very quickly disabused, first in the Congo and then in Bolivia, where he showed up in 1966. And there is Che at the bottom right there looking particularly hairy. The situation he found in Bolivia was quite different from the one he'd encountered in Cuba, because Bolivia was not led by this unpopular, unelected dictator. In fact, it had a popular, elected president who had already instituted land reform, which was the chief Marxist calling card. By contrast, Che came in with a handful of outsiders, not a Bolivian among them. They didn't speak the local Indian language. They had very little support in Bolivian society. It's probably fair to say that during his time in Bolivia, Che's best friend was his mule Chico. So it's no great surprise that within a relatively short period of time, he was hunted down by these guys, Bolivian Army Rangers, trained by US Army Special Forces and assisted by the CIA. And this was the end of Che Guevara in 1967, his corpse being poked by his enemies. Now, I would suggest that if even Che Guevara, one of the most storied insurgents in history, could be defeated and killed, any insurgency can be defeated. The question is, how? Well, we're very lucky in this regard that two of the great powers of Europe, Britain and France, ran a controlled experiment in counterinsurgency for our benefit in the 1950s, showing different ways of fighting and how they would work out. On the one hand, you had the French and Algeria from 1954 to 1962. On the other hand, you had the British in Malaya from 1948 to 1960. The French approach was really emblematic of the male fist, brute force approach to counterinsurgency. The British, on the other hand, came to be seen as representative of what is now known as population-centric or hearts and minds counterinsurgency. Now, what does all of that mean in practice? Well, if you want to get a sense of what the French did in Algeria, you actually don't have to sit here and listen to me. You can just go home and rent that great movie, The Battle of Algiers, which gives a pretty accurate overview of what happened in 1957 when the FLN was setting off bombs in Algiers that were killing civilians, and especially European civilians. The French police and intelligence service were helpless. They could not crack these insurgent networks. And so in desperation, they turned to the elite of the French army, the 10th Parachute Division, under General Jacques Massu. Very quickly, the paratroopers marched into Algiers and took control of the Casbah, the native quarter, and began rounding up thousands of men for interrogation to figure out who were the insurgents lurking in their midst. Now, we know what happened in these interrogation centers, because in part because of the testimony of this man, Henri Alleg, who was not himself Algerian, he was French, a French Jew actually, who ran a Republican newspaper in Algiers. But this was enough for him to be arrested by the paratroopers. Now we know about, I think we all know about medieval instruments of torture like the rack or the Iron Maiden. Well, Henri Alleg was to be introduced to a peculiarly modern and fiendish form of torture, what the French security forces called the Gijane. Basically a very simple dynamo created initially to power field telephones. It has a couple of clips that you attach to whoever you're interrogating, and it has a handle that you turn. And the faster you turn that handle, the more electricity comes out of the machine. Now, Henri Alleg was to learn what the Gijane could do when he was stripped bare at this interrogation center, dragged into a room, tied to a wooden board with leather straps, and he had the clips applied to his ear and his finger. He wrote, "A flash of lightning exploded next to my ear, and I felt my heart racing in my breast. I struggled, screaming." When he still would not tell the paratroopers what they wanted to hear, they took one of the clips off his ear and attached it to his penis. He said that my body shook with nervous shocks, getting stronger in intensity. But still he would not crack, and so the paratroopers dragged him off the table using his necktie. They pummeled him viciously with their fists, and then they introduced him to another method of torture, what they called the tuyau, what we know better as waterboarding. Henri Alleg wrote, "I had the impression of drowning, and a terrible agony of death itself took possession of me." After this ordeal, he was tossed in a cell, still naked, left to spend the night on a barbed wire mattress, listening to the thuds and screams of other detainees in this facility getting similar treatment. Now, it's commonly said that torture doesn't work. If only that were so. Torture may be morally reprehensible, but it can also be tactically effective. At least it was for the French in the Battle of Algiers, because using these methods of interrogation, the paratroopers managed to crack the FLN network within Algiers in relatively short order. By the end of 1957, no more bombs were going off. And so the French could congratulate themselves that they had won their war on terror. But as we know, with the benefit of hindsight, they had won a tactical victory at the cost of strategic defeat, because there was no way to keep secret what was happening in this large city not far from the shores of Europe. Henri Alleg, for one, after being released from custody, wrote a best-selling book, The Question, which uncovered the methods which were being routinely used by French security forces. And once the French people saw what was being done in their name, these Gestapo-like tactics, they turned against the war, as did people in the United States, as did the United Nations, as did the entire international community, so that by 1962, de Gaulle had no choice but to grant Algeria its independence. Now that's a pretty vivid demonstration to my mind of the dangers of being overly brutal in counterinsurgency. Now at this very same time, at the other corner of the world, a very different approach to counterinsurgency was being demonstrated by this man, General Sir Gerald Templer, who should not be confused with this man, David Niven, for whom he is a dead ringer. this man was the commander, took over as commander of British forces in Malaya in 1952. And when he arrived, he found that the Malayan Racist Liberation Army, one of many nationalist slash Marxist insurgent groups of the time, was running amok. They were blowing up trains. They even killed his predecessor. So that Templar had to go from the airport in Kuala Lumpur to Government House, riding in the very same car in which the previous High Commissioner had been shot to death. The bullet holes were still in it. That must have been a fun ride. It would have been very understandable if under those circumstances Templar had decided he had no choice but to use terror in order to get the population into line. But that's not what he did, because he understood that the key to victory was not in terrorizing the population, it was in controlling the population. And so how did he go about controlling the population? Well, one of his most effective instruments was the creation of these new villages, because he understood that the insurgency drew much of its strength from this population of Chinese squatters who were not citizens of Malaya, who had no title to their land, who were outsiders to Malayan society, and therefore were ripe for the siren song of communism. So one of the most important things that Templar did was to relocate thousands and tens of thousands of these Chinese squatters into these new villages where they would have sanitation, clinics, schools, fields to till. And oh, by the way, they would also be surrounded by fences and armed guards to cut them off physically from being able to support the insurgency. He did other things as well, such as sending aircraft to overfly insurgent-held areas, not to bomb them, but to drop leaflets calling them to surrender, and sometimes equipped with loudspeakers that actually called down to the ground and called out individual insurgents by name, which was a spooky and effective tactic. He did other things as well, such as ending the fruitless jungle bashing in which the British Army had engaged in Malaya, as the American Army would later do in Vietnam, sending these large formations thrashing through the jungle in a futile quest to pin down these wily and elusive guerrillas. Instead, Templar placed his emphasis on intelligence, on expanding special branch, figuring out exactly where the insurgent lairs were, and then targeting them using the SAS and other special troops. He even imported headhunters from Borneo to guide his men to where the insurgents were. But the key to what he did was keeping his eye on the people. Templar is famous for two sayings. He said, first, the shooting side of the business is only 25% of the trouble, and the other 75% lies in getting the people of the country behind us. He also said, the answer lies not in pouring more troops into the jungles, but in the hearts and minds of the people. That's where that phrase became popular, hearts and minds. And it's something that has often been misunderstood to suggest that somehow the insurgents are simply out there to win a popularity contest, to hand out lots of goodies to the population. That's not what it's about at all. It's actually much more hard-headed than that, and it really consists of paying attention to two fundamental tenets of counterinsurgency. First, security, and second, legitimacy. The security part we've already discussed, which was achieved through the new villages, through carefully targeted raids and so forth. But legitimacy was also incredibly important because Templar understood that it was very difficult, if not impossible, to keep a restive population down indefinitely at bayonet point. You needed to offer them something positive, some positive reason why they should support the security forces, and that's precisely what he did. Templar offered the people of Malaya a deal. He said, if you support us, the British, to suppress this communist insurgency, we will offer you, the people of Malaya, independence. That was a pretty good deal. That was something that the people of Malaya wanted, and that gave them a positive reason to cooperate with the security forces. It would seem like a no-brainer, but the French didn't do that in Algeria. They were trying to get the people of Algeria to fight for a continuation of French colonial rule, which, not surprisingly, did not prove very popular. Now, the basics of counterinsurgency, which Templar displayed in Malaya, and really this fundamental focus on security and legitimacy, I think have characterized most successful counterinsurgency campaigns throughout history, whether in the days of the Romans or more recently in Northern Ireland, El Salvador, Iraq during the surge in 2007, 2008, or other examples. Now, why does it matter? Why should we even be thinking about this at all? Well, last week I was in Washington, and you know, a lot of people in Washington will tell you it doesn't matter. We've gotten out of Iraq, we're getting out of Afghanistan. All the talk in the Beltway these days is about the pivot to the Pacific. There's a lot of sentiment within the armed forces. We're going to get out of the counterinsurgency business. We want to get back to conventional soldiering. Well, that's a very good idea, but I'm afraid that reality may not cooperate, because I don't think that there are going to be too many enemies in the future as obliging as Saddam Hussein, who are going to put a massive tank army out there in the desert with a big hit me sign on it. If they did, it would be lovely from the standpoint of the United States military or the British military or other advanced Western militaries, because this is exactly the kind of war that we are all best equipped and trained to fight. But I would argue that our enemies are not entirely imbeciles, and they can read the lessons of history, which is that irregular warfare has a much higher chance of success against a superpower than meeting that superpower head on in an open battlefield. And in fact, irregular warfare continues. Osama bin Laden may be dead, but Al-Qaeda remains very much alive, as the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi on September 11th of last year should remind us. Not only is Al-Qaeda alive, but it's actually spread to places like Mali and Libya and Syria, where it was not seriously present before. And indeed, the threat from groups like Al-Qaeda could well be growing, because one of the most disturbing trends of the last 100 years is the growing killing capacity at the hands of the individual. And just think about this. A century ago, when Western armies were campaigning in the Third World, their opposition was often armed with nothing more than bows and arrows, spears, a few muskets. Today, however, there is no corner of the world so remote that every young man doesn't have access to an AK-47, a rocket-propelled grenade, explosives, very simple infantry weapons, but ones that have taken a fearsome toll among American and British forces in Afghanistan and Iraq over the last decade. And what might the future hold? Well, it's not outside the realm of possibility that insurgents could get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. If that were to happen, you could well have a small terrorist cell of, let's say, 20 people with more killing capacity than the entire army of a non-nuclear state like Germany or Brazil. That's a pretty terrifying prospect, because I'm very much concerned that George Clooney may not be around to save us. And what if George is not there to save the day? Well, I would refer you with my closing slide to this map, which comes from a magazine that I'm sure all of you avidly read. You probably have stacks of it in your basement. I refer, of course, to the International Journal of Health Geographics. This is the 2007 issue, for those of you who are trying to think back. And this is from an article which studies what would happen if various sized nuclear devices were set off in various American cities. And notice how considered I'm being here, because I'm displaying a map of what would happen to my hometown, not to the city where all of you live, but the damage would probably be somewhat similar. This is a model of a 20 kiloton nuclear device going off in downtown Manhattan. And 20 kilotons is not very powerful. It's about the same size as the bomb that leveled Nagasaki in 1945. The strategic arsenals of Russia, the United States, China are full of much more powerful nuclear warheads. But even a 20 kiloton device, it is estimated, would kill more than 600,000 people and injure more than 1.6 million. In other words, it would make 9/11 look like a Sunday in the park by comparison. Now, I don't mean to unduly alarm anybody here or to suggest that somehow a nuclear attack on a major Western city is going to happen tomorrow. Knock on wood, it'll never happen. But we have to acknowledge the possibility that it could happen. And certainly if one looks at North Korea testing nuclear weapons, if one looks at Pakistan growing ever more unstable, if one looks at Iran drawing ever closer to acquiring a nuclear weapon of its own, the prospect does not seem entirely far-fetched. The reality is that insurgents are becoming potentially more destructive than they've ever been. And they've already been plenty destructive, as I hope this short historical survey has indicated. barbarians brought down the Roman Empire. Today we face our own barbarians. And I would submit that the first line of defense is simply to understand the problem, to understand the history of insurgency and counterinsurgency. And that's what I've tried to do with this book, for which I'm very grateful for Jeff giving me the time to present today.